Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, my co-host, Micah Sargent, and we've got a great show for you today. Ethereum has officially merged. And what exactly does that mean? Well, David Yaffe Bellany from the New York Times explains. Also, Yonko Rutgers from Protocol joins us to talk about this looming recession that we're kind of in the middle of and how there are price-conscious devices on the horizon that might capitalize on that. I talked a little bit about leg lengthening surgery. It is definitely a tech light story, but very interesting to me and to Micah because, well, we are tall people. And then Micah shares how TikTok is getting in on the Be Real craze with a clone of its own. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Week.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 252, recorded Thursday, September 15th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player.
And by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player.
And by Podium, join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we, and I do mean we this week, talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy here, actually, this time, Jason Howell. It's good to be back. Sorry to leave you hanging last week.
That's okay. You know, every time, there have been multiple times where I have had to reference the previous week for different stuff. And I keep forgetting that it was just last week that the Apple event took place and I was in Cupertino and all that stuff. It seems like it was so long ago. So, wow.
It's good. It's kind of like stepping in a time machine. Yeah, exactly.
A little bit. Exactly. A little bit.
All right. We're going to start with some news that's very recent, actually. Early this morning, Ethereum saw a monumental upgrade to its software architecture. Many you probably heard have been referring to this as the merge. People looking for good news in crypto might actually have a moment to make them happy right now. It's a cause for celebration, definitely a big deal to people who are close to Ethereum. And joining us to help us understand the merge and what it means for crypto is David Yaffe Bellany from the New York Times. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's really good to get you here. So first of all, let's tackle the main differences between proof of work, which is the framework that powered Ethereum before the merge, and then of course proof of stake, which is the way that it is going forward. What are the, if you had to summarize this for someone who's trying to follow along, because I know, you know, in the crypto world, there's a lot of definitions and everything that can kind of fly over people's heads. How would you explain the differences? Why is this better?
So to understand the differences, it's first important to think about the problem that crypto is trying to solve. It's trying to create a means of sending money that doesn't involve any type of intermediary or gatekeeper. You know, in a traditional transaction, a bank would verify that one entity has enough money to send it to another entity. In crypto, you have to find another technique to verify transactions. And the original solution that people came up with was this system called proof of work, which is basically a bunch of computers racing to solve cryptographic puzzles that in the process kind of confirm that, you know, transactions are legitimate. But it's a super energy guzzling process. You know, running all those computers consumes a huge amount of electricity. And so that's one of the main reasons that people have been drawn to this alternative called proof of stake, where instead of this computational race among bunches of different computers, you have a kind of lottery where people put up money, you're sort of entered into the lottery, and then you're chosen at random to validate a transaction rather than having to kind of race for that opportunity. And in both systems, a reward comes with that privilege of validating a transaction. You're paid a small amount of cryptocurrency as payment for that.
Is everybody who's really steeped in the world of Ethereum in particular, like, is the majority of people excited about this, or are there people who are like, you know, I really don't want this to happen? I don't know. I hear a lot of positivity about it, but I have to imagine there's people who feel like this shouldn't happen. What are those reasons?
Yeah, I mean, the Ethereum community is mostly thrilled about this. This is sort of widely considered a kind of good news moment for crypto in what's been a generally pretty grim year. But yes, there are groups that are opposed to it. I mean, mostly groups that are financially invested in that proof of work system. So crypto miners who've built, you know, huge warehouses full of computers that are running on proof of work, now suddenly a means of income has been snatched away from them as Ethereum transitions to this new proof of stake consensus mechanism. And so there's been pushback from those groups. There's also been pushback from, you know, Bitcoiners who are sort of philosophically opposed to Ethereum for various reasons. There have been dissenting voices that have said, wait, why are we doing something this risky that could kind of upset the whole industry if it were to go wrong? You know, the common comparison you hear is that it's like changing a plane's engine mid-flight, that's the level of risk that's involved here.
And it has not been a short time coming either. This is a transition that's been in the works for quite a while. I mean, largely because of the complexity that you're talking about. What has it taken behind the scenes to actually get to this point? I mean, when I think of an airplane changing engines mid-flight, like that's a massive undertaking. This obviously sounds incredibly complex and complicated. How did this actually happen then? How were they able to pull this off?
Sure. So one complexity that made it take so long is that Ethereum is not a company. This wasn't some like behind closed doors project. It wasn't like Apple, you know, unveiling the newest iPhone. Ethereum is a huge open source project where engineers around the world are working on constantly. And so it was this kind of like motley group of people in different countries that were collaborating on this. And there are certainly advantages to that type of process, but without a kind of top-down authority, things can also take a lot longer. So that's sort of one kind of high-level reason that it's taken so long. And then also there's just a high level of technological complexity. These developers had to build an entirely new blockchain, which is the kind of public ledger where cryptocurrency transactions are recorded. They had to test to make sure that it was working properly, and then they had to figure out how to merge it. That's why this process is called the merge with the existing Ethereum blockchain. And that's what happened yesterday, a few minutes before midnight West Coast time.
Yeah. So obviously very early on in the actual kind of new era of Ethereum and how Ethereum works. But there's always the risk. I mean, there's still a risk, right? Like, I mean, the merge happened officially and everybody was like, it almost like to a certain degree for me, it kind of feels like Y2K. It's like, we think that there's a possibility that something bad might happen. We'll flip the switch and we'll see. And at the end of the day, you know, with Y2K, it really didn't end up being that big a deal. Easy for me to say, I didn't do all the work behind the scenes. But here we have this merge that, yes, has happened, but are there still risks? Like, is there some scenario where we go, whoa, wait a minute, we didn't account for that. This is a bad deal.
I think most of the kind of short-term worst-case scenarios we already know now, we've kind of avoided. Yeah. That would have become clear sort of in the immediate aftermath of the merge. It's certainly possible that bugs, glitches, hacking vulnerabilities will be discovered in the next few weeks. But if you speak with the developers behind Ethereum, they're very confident that those are things they'll be able to address kind of case by case, and that won't have any sort of system-wide impact. There are kind of longer-term concerns about what type of effect this would have on the kind of crypto community. One fear is that it could create more centralization, which of course is a big kind of something that the crypto people want to avoid. You know, there are, you know, only so many people who can afford to put up the money that allows you to operate as a staker in the system validating transactions. There are, you know, big exchanges that hold huge amounts of ether that will be potentially in a position to kind of help dictate the staking process. And so there's a concern that the government could lean on those sorts of entities and that could prove a kind of roadblock toward this like vision of absolute decentralization that really kind of powers crypto.
Yeah, right. Well, that's interesting. And you've also mentioned the environmental impacts. I feel like you know, year after year, for anyone who is detracting or, you know, kind of anti-crypto, this is kind of near the top. You know, there's the kind of scammy side of crypto that people point to. There's also the environmental impact. And this seems to be, at least from my understanding, a step in the right direction. Explain why this is so different from an environmental standpoint.
Yeah, so it goes back to that distinction between proof of work and proof of stake. In proof of work, you have all these computers running, consuming huge amounts of electricity. In proof of stake, you can think of it more like a lottery than a race. You know, computers are selected at random to validate transactions versus competing to do so. And so that requires much, much less electricity. Some estimates put it at over 99% less. And so that's a huge step forward for the crypto community, which, you know, people have criticized for years because of its energy costs.
Yeah, well, and not just, you know, Ethereum, Bitcoin also falls into this category, still operates on a proof of work system. Is there any chance or any likelihood, you know, when one player in a space, and I realize, you know, nobody owns and controls Ethereum necessarily, but when one entity in a space does something and proves that it can happen, often that can motivate others to kind of follow suit. Bitcoin, I would imagine, you know, everyone would probably agree is kind of the biggest player in the room, but still on the proof of work system. Could this incentivize, could this be an example that other cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin might follow in the footsteps of?
I think it's unlikely that Bitcoin would switch to proof of stake. I mean, the people who are most invested in Bitcoin are kind of deeply ideologically committed to proof of work, argue that it's more secure and less centralized than proof of stake. Now you get people on the proof of stake side making the same arguments in favor of their system. So there are definitely kind of valid points on each side, but it would be a big surprise if Bitcoin were to switch over. And like you say, there's no Bitcoin Incorporated that would power that.
Right.
It would really have to be a kind of community-wide consensus, which just seems not really possible.
Yeah, not likely. And then finally, is the cost that's associated with transacting in crypto, let's say. Gas fees, anyone who's ever kind of looked into trading crypto, buying into a certain crypto, there's always this associated, often anyways, there's this associated gas fee that in some cases can be more than what is being purchased, right? And same goes for Ethereum. Does this have any impact on those fees? Will this possibly lower the cost of transacting in crypto?
So you're right. That's been one of the real barriers to Ethereum kind of catching on with the wider audience. It costs a lot of money to conduct a transaction in Ether. And that's a big problem that the Ethereum developers have appreciated for a long time. The merge won't solve it immediately, but it does kind of lay the groundwork for future upgrades that will ideally happen over the coming months and years that will minimize fees. That's probably an even more crucial step toward greater adoption than eliminating the environmental costs.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you breaking down all of the complexities around the merge, the Ethereum merge. Thank you so much. David Yaffe Bellany, of course, writes for the New York Times. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter and at the New York Times website. So follow our work there.
All right. Right on. Thank you, David. We appreciate your time. We'll talk with you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right. Coming up, with inflation come a crop of gadgets set to capitalize on tightening budgets. We're going to talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Compiler. It's an original podcast from Red Hat. It's devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. It's hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino. And Compiler really just closes the gap between those who are new to technology and those behind the inventions, behind the services that are shaping our world. It's really fascinating stuff. Compiler brings together stories and perspectives from the industry and simplifies its language, its culture, its movements in a way that's fun, it's informative, and it's guilt-free. So if you want to stay on top of tech without the time spent, well, you want to check out Compiler. It's an original podcast from Red Hat. It presents those perspectives, those topics, those insights that you're looking for from the tech industry, free from jargon, free from judgment. You can learn along with everyone else. They want to discover where technology is headed, beyond just the headlines and create a place for new IT professionals to learn, to grow, to thrive. Compiler helps people break through barriers and challenges, turns code into community at all levels of the enterprise. And they've just got some really fantastic episodes. One episode, the Great Stack Debate, software stack. As you may or may not know, it's like an onion, right? It's like sheets, maybe even a sheet cake or a lasagna. Or is it? You know, it's often described as having layers that sit on top of each other. The reality is much more complicated. Of course, as technology often is, it's more complicated than what you might think. And learning about it can help any tech career. The Great Stack Debate is the first episode in Compiler's series on the software stack. They call it Stack Unstuck. They explore each layer of the stack, what it's like to work on them, how they come together into a whole application. It's really, it's fascinating because it picks apart if you're not, you know, working with these things inherently. And this is kind of the beauty of the Compiler series. It brings you into the process so that you get a better understanding of what's going on behind the scenes without complicating things and muddying it up with, you know, jargon and everything. You learn a lot about software stacks. It's really great. Another episode covers, are we as productive as we think? You know, the pressure to balance productivity with passion projects, personal responsibilities, or just with the need to rest. It can be really challenging. And their team actually spoke with tech-minded creators in the productivity space on how to achieve full focus and how to make time for work, for relaxation, for creativity. These are all things, you know, you can be so focused on work that you don't leave time for the other things because they seem less important. But really, that has a trickle-down effect on how effective you are with your work. That's kind of what they talk about. Learn more about Compiler at red.ht/twit. You can listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. We will include a link in the show notes. Our thanks to Compiler for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Mike, over to you.
Yes, it is time. You may or may not have noticed that companies, especially consumer technology companies, are responding to inflation and tightening budgets all sorts of different ways. There are all kinds of mechanisms they're using to shore up the earnings and make sure that they can continue in business. Joining us to talk about one observation regarding consumer tech is Protocol's own Yinko Rutgers. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's so good to get you here. Firstly, you noticed a trend in entry-level and budget technology making its way to the market kind of in a big way. And as I was reading this piece, I kind of had this moment as a former writer myself. I was just curious kind of what was it? When did you have this realization that kind of gave you that aha moment of this trend of entry-level budget tech really playing a role in maybe the next few years?
Yeah, it kind of slowly dawned on me. Gearing up towards the holiday season, there's always leaks about devices. We at Protocol reported early on about the Chromecast HD, which is a streaming device that Google is going to introduce that is sort of on the lower end, even cheaper than the existing Chromecast. And there was some talk about the Sonos subwoofer, the Sub Mini early on. And I think it really dawned on me, though, when I got a briefing from Roku recently a couple of weeks back, and they were saying, well, our new device this year is our entry-level device, remade, same price, and we have a cheaper subwoofer as well. I thought, wait a minute, that's sort of a trifecta here. There must be something there. When the company that's already selling devices for fairly cheap is now focusing on their $30 device as sort of the holiday, the new holiday announcement.
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to kind of hear where you had those wait a minute moments. Those are. Interesting moments for sure. Now, it may be obvious to some folks, but I do want to ask, why are companies introducing these low-end or entry-level devices at this time? What is the goal here as far as you see it?
I think it is really a response to the inflation and just people paying a lot more. I think I heard on the radio the other day that the average family has $5,000 more expenses per year. that leaves a lot less money for many people to spend on gadgets. And if you don't need to renew it, maybe you won't buy anything new. And if you want to buy a new device when it comes to streaming, for example, if you want to, add streaming to another TV in your household, you may be looking for cheaper devices because you don't want to break the bank and everything else is getting more expensive. So it makes a lot of sense for these companies to target those consumers who are on a budget this holiday season.
Absolutely. Now, some companies, it seems, in response to these changes in income and inflation, they instead chose to raise prices on their products. We saw that from Meta and the Meta Quest VR headset, as well as, I believe it was Sony? Yes, Sony, and the PlayStation. Why do you think that some companies, like Roku, for example, have chosen to keep the prices the same or even introduce lower-cost products? And kind of which products are out there right now or coming out soon that fall kind of into this bucket, other than, of course, the Roku that we mentioned earlier?
I think, again, I mentioned a couple of devices. The Chromecast HD is a pretty interesting example. We don't know the pricing yet because it hasn't officially been announced yet. But there were some leaks that suggested it may be 40% less than the existing device. Sonos also, it's a company that actually did raise prices last year, but now it's bringing out a cheaper subwoofer that's significantly less expensive than the existing model. So some companies are trying to do both in a way. And I think it comes really down to the business model that each company has. Because companies that do make money primarily with hardware, their chips prices are getting up, logistics are getting more expensive. They just have to respond to this if they don't want to go into the red with their devices. They have to raise the prices eventually. Companies like Roku and Google and Amazon as well are a little different because they primarily make the money with advertising, with services. So the hardware is really a way for them to grow the platform, to get more people use their products and services and then sell ads to them or show ads to them, sell services to them. And Roku actually has been very transparent about that, and they're selling the devices basically below cost. They started that last year when chips were getting more expensive, and they continue to do that. And I've asked them, are you going to raise prices on all the other things now? And they said, no, we're going to just eat this, eat the difference, and hope to make it up on the back end, essentially.
Yeah, because I guess I could see that there may be some folks who, if they are looking for a new thing and they see that everything else has gone up in price, but Roku is able to maintain that lower price, then you do get more folks, in theory, who are getting them, at which point then there are more devices on which Roku is able to serve advertisements. So you talk about Sonos sales missing expectations, and part of the reason, according to one of the folks on kind of the earnings call, was that TV sales have slowed because TVs are going up in price along with many other things. And I was kind of curious, from what you have seen, is this symbiotic relationship common in the consumer tech market? So in other words, do you know if it's common for consumer tech companies to kind of have to make adjustments to their own product lineup based on the sales performance of other companies? Of course, when it comes to something like chips, where these companies are buying components, that's one thing. But I was hoping you could explain, you do talk about it in your piece, why a Sonos soundbar is affected by TV sales. And then if you've seen this with other consumer level, entry level gadgets that have hit the market or soon to hit the market.
I don't think we see that as often. One area that I could think of or can think of is sort of the mobile space, where mobile accessories, headphones and so forth, they're largely dependent on phones selling well. And so once that slows down, those companies are also sort of in a bind a little bit. It's newer for the TV, but I think it speaks to the role that the TV is starting to have, starting to become a bigger piece of home entertainment with smart TVs in particular. And that does not only affect hardware, so Sonos, but also is starting to affect actually streaming services as well. So when Netflix saw their subscriber numbers decline for the first time in basically ever earlier this year, they also blamed TV sales, because if few people can afford to buy TVs, and TVs did get significantly more expensive last year, then there's fewer people who may sign up for Netflix. So that reduces the market. In the end, it's kind of hard to tell, obviously, whether this is really executives blaming their own shortcomings on something else or whether that truly is because there's fewer TVs out there. It's probably a mixture of both in those cases, but it is interesting that there's a sort of a symbiosis.
Yeah, especially in your piece, you talk about these sort of bundle deals that often take place. And I hadn't really considered that when someone buys a new TV at a big box store, they can or even on Amazon, you'll often see buy this and you can get this with it for free or for $15 extra or what have you. And when the company is partially relying on sort of being in more homes so that they can sell more ads, that's when those bundle deals start to make sense. And that made sense in terms of that symbiotic relationship that existed there. I didn't ask this originally, but I am curious, do we know why TV sales, or rather TV prices increased? Does it have to do with the chip shortage, or is this the supply chain regarding displays in that case?
I think, first of all, you have to note that TVs have gotten a lot cheaper over the years. I've been tracking that for a little while. And I think the average price of a TV has declined like few other gadgets that I can think of over the last couple of decades. Basically gotten cheaper every year. And part of that had to do with how that market has evolved. So a couple of years back when smart TVs first became a thing, it was primarily big companies like Samsung and LG, sort of the premium manufacturers coming from Korea selling these devices. And they were more expensive. And then more recently, you've seen companies like TCL and other Chinese manufacturers like Hisense really gain market share and eat it away from these premium brands. And those brands primarily have been successful because they're a lot cheaper. So they're coming out of China. They're a lot cheaper. They have everything integrated in manufacturing. But then they were also very vulnerable to chip shortages, to shutdowns because of COVID. And all those things have slowed down specifically or especially the business coming out of China a lot over the last year or two. And that really has hit TV prices and TV margins hard.
Now that makes sense. And thank you for that tidbit on TV prices dropping more than many other consumer tech gadgets. I sort of, you know, when you say that, then I can look back and go, huh, yeah, that is interesting, and sort of have that realization. So it's good to have that pointed out. Now, lastly, I'm curious, from everything that you know, looking into the crystal ball here, do you think that the low price, kind of low performance, budget friendly segment is here to stay? Or is this kind of a stopgap measure because of inflation, because of everything going on right now, the shutdowns, the slowdowns, et cetera? And will we see a return to that heavy focus on the faster, better, stronger from these companies once the market stabilizes?
I think there's always going to be demand for some of these flagship devices that you're going to sell on the higher end. But the bigger change is probably not even related to inflation or recession or anything like that at all, but more to the change in business models. So we've seen that with streaming devices, we've increasingly seen that with TV sets, where these companies aren't making money anymore primarily with selling these devices, but now with the services that come later on. So if you turn on your Samsung TV these days, it has a TV Plus service built in. It's like free channels, and Samsung makes money on the back end by putting ads in there. Same goes for LG, same goes for Vizio. All these companies are starting to monetize heavily on the back end through advertising, which changes their business model because then the margins can be slimmer. They're not as dependent on making as much money with these flagship models. Bringing a TV out for $300 if they can afford it is a lot more attractive because it gets those eyeballs in. It gets more eyeballs in than a $2,000 TV, right? So I think that shift has happened over the last couple of years already. All of this that's happening right now with the pandemic, with inflation, is sort of accelerating it. But I think it's going to be here to stay even after the economy recovers.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us to give us your insight on these inflation gadgets. Of course, folks can head over to protocol.com to read your excellent work. But if they want to follow you online to stay up to date, is there a place they can go to do that?
Sure. So, protocol.com is a good starting point. But I'm also on Twitter where I'm JANK0. I made it a little difficult many years ago, but I'm sticking with it. So you can follow me there as well.
You got to stick with it. JANK0. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. And I'm sure we'll see you back on the show soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Up next, it's Jason Howell's story of the week, having to do something with height. Interesting. Both of us are pretty tall guys. Before we get there, though, let us take a quick break so I can tell you about the awesome, the incredible IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. So IRL, it's a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. And I want to be clear about something. When you hear that, it's for people who, you might think that what we're saying is this is a show for this group, meaning like the people who build AI and the people who develop tech policies are the ones who should listen to the show. No. Everyone should listen to the show. It is not for those people. It's about people who are building AI and about people who are developing tech policies. So you can learn about them. And that kind of opens up, broadens the group a little bit. The show is hosted by Bridget Todd. And this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. We ask the questions, who can AI help? And who can it harm? The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. There's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. You'll hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. There's another episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against those algorithms that control how much they get paid, and also looking to new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. And then there's the episode for the political junkies, episodes about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections, which of course is a huge concern for democracies around the world. I gotta tell you, my favorite episode, this is season 6, but it's episode 5. It's called the AI Medicine Cabinet. And this episode just came out a few days ago. And what I love about this is it's looking at how AI plays a role in health and in medicine. And one of the conversations surrounds Avery Smith, who I just love this. He created an online service for people of color where you can upload photos of your skin and different skin conditions that you're worried about and have AI work to help identify what the heck is going on. Because largely the database for skin conditions, skin concerns, skin cancer are white people and white skin. And it can often be missed in people of color because it may present differently on our skin. So having a place you can go that is specific to our skin, our pigmented skin, or deeply pigmented skin, I should say, gives the ability to kind of learn about what's going on there. And what I love too is that in uploading, of course, there's a privacy policy and everything. In uploading, you are helping to improve upon the AI engine that is creating that. That is just one of the stories in this episode. So lots of really interesting stuff, but I had to give a shout out to Mela Logic, which if you, melanin, I see, Mela Logic. Anyway, definitely check out that episode. I love a good pun. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And of course, we'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to IRL for their support of this episode of Tech News Weekly and all of TWIT. Thank you. And go check it out. All right, Jason Howell, Mr. Tall Guy, tell us about your story of the week.
Yeah, so I'm realizing as I'm kind of like, rehashing the story that I picked out here, it's really light technology. It's more biotech than anything else. So consider that. But it was a story that caught my attention. And this is a podcast where we are allowed to bring stories that catch our attention and talk about them. So I was like, why not? It's very tangential on technology, but it's still fascinating. GQ has a story about a procedure that I had never heard of before. Maybe you have, Micah. It's a leg lengthening procedure for people who wish to be taller than they are. You can kind of see the hero image on this article on the right. You can kind of see kind of like a model of what's going on here. It costs anywhere between $75,000 to $150,000 to do this.
Oh, and my goodness.
Yeah, and it can add anywhere from 3 to 6 inches to a person's height. So after everything that I'm about to tell you about, you know, you get 3 to 6 inches, which I imagine, I mean, that's a, you know, that's half a foot potentially. So that's a pretty, that's a stretch. Okay, pun intended. there we go.
Pick up on that one. Yeah.
There we go. So of course the person has to heal from the surgery in order to make those gains, initially. So how does this work? And I'll just kind of give you a little bit of a warning.
It's a little horribly painful.
It's a little graphic. I'm going to keep it PG rated for you, but the procedure entails having both of your femurs broken. And then what's called an Ilzerov frame is wrapped around each leg. It extends from the ankle to the knee. It's inserted into the bones along the way, top to bottom, with titanium nails. And those nails can be slowly tightened over time. And that's important. Every day post-surgery, those nails are tightened to allow for an extension of 1 millimeter of length per day for 90 days. Okay. So every day,
so that your body can slowly adjust to it.
Yes. Every day lengthening that leg, that femur, and you know, along with this kind of attachment inside of each leg. All this is controlled with a magnetic remote. So there's your technology. Sure. A magnetic remote. And then over that time, new bone tissue grows to fill in the gap that happens to be left between the two pieces of broken femur. So that's about as graphic as this gets. I could have gone into further detail, but we don't need to. But that gives you an idea of just how dramatic this surgery is. And you consider in this case that any of the height gains actually come entirely from the legs, right? So, you know, I'm a 6'8" person. And I don't know how evenly distributed my height is from, you know, upper body to lower body. I know that I've got longer legs than I do probably my torso, I believe. So I'm maybe a little bit longer in the legs than I am the rest of my body. But there's a proportionality that's there that if you do something like this, imagine adding 6 feet to your legs, you know, something to consider. The proportions might be off, but the height. So as a result, that height distribution can be a little bit unbalanced, is my point. The nerves and the tissue around the bones are stretched in order to do this, which is apparently, as you can imagine, incredibly painful. One person interviewed for the article, who happens to be a father of three, by the way, said he couldn't walk for months. It was that painful. So painful that he couldn't walk. I can't even imagine doing this.
This is making my legs feel all tingly. And, oh, man, I'm, like, having trouble sitting still. Because your bone is spongy for a period of time, and you have to – I'm sorry. I don't want to – no spoilers. Continue.
No. So that frame that I was talking about, the Ilzerov frame, that's on your leg for literal months, or on each leg for months. So you've got this frame that's wrapped around, you know, both legs for months at a time while all this is happening. You know, they warn that any spill, any fall could easily re-break either of those bones in a number of different ways. So you have to be incredibly careful. The whole process, by the way, starts all over if that happens, and as does the cost of it all, really expensive. Anyways, this is just something that, like I said, I don't know how technology roped into technology this is, but it's fascinating to me, like as a tall person, I guess it makes sense. I've met a lot of people who I tell them how tall I am, and they're like, oh, I wish I was tall, or yes, I wish I was taller, or whatever.
I've heard that too, plenty of times.
Yeah, totally. Or the, you know, do you play basketball? No, and then they're like disappointed in me.
Yes, yes, same.
It's like, oh, if I had your height, I'd play basketball. It's like, well.
My dad was a basketball coach, too, so you can imagine how disappointing it was that his very tall son was not a basketball player.
Right, right.
The way that the story is told, of course, is kind of through, you know, what is the word I'm looking for? It is a narrative. And the part where the person who had this done comes in and the doctor is, you can tell, like a little upset. And what it ends up being is that the guy, John, as they call him, I don't know if that's John's real name, was supposed to still be wearing crutches, was supposed to still be using crutches, and was not, didn't have his crutches with him. And it's like, you have to do that. You have to keep, otherwise this could start all over. They said 95% healed on the left side, 80% healed on the right side. And it was still about 3 weeks until the process was fully complete. Like, I'm sorry. I guess, okay. I guess I do have a moment where I go, if someone's able to drop $70,000 to $125,000 on this, then they probably can be a little bit, you know, lackadaisical or laissez-faire with their funds. But at the same time, I cannot imagine making this investment and then not doing everything exactly, you know, what the doctor says and tells me to do. I mean, most of all, because I would be worried about the, not just harming my investment, but what happens when one of those titanium screws or nails or whatever it is gets shifted into one of my organs because I take a fall. Like, no, I'm going to do it. I will be in a wheelchair until it's done if you want me to. Like, whatever it is that I need to do, I would do. I can't imagine wanting, and John was saying that
he's excited.
He was just, he was really excited. He just wanted to be that taller version of himself. So,
It's interesting. The article talks about why someone would want to do this. You know, the national average for men's height in the U.S. is 5'9". And, you know, the article points out that shorter men are precluded from certain things. Short guys make less money, about $500 a year per inch, which I think is a really interesting stat. Less likely to climb the corporate ladder. The average height of male Fortune 500 CEOs is 6 foot. So there's, so there's this perspective that, oh, well, if I'm taller, then I will get all these things. Fewer opportunities with women for cis straight men, of course. You know, so there are reasons, but man, that's a lot of money and a lot of pain to go through in order to do this. At the same time, I think, you know, and they point out, you know, trans men is one group, you know, that is using the procedure to feel more like themselves, feel like the them that they feel inside of themselves. Patients who are more often than not, patients are of the upper echelon. So, you know, the doctor featured in the article said much of his clientele are, quote, tech bros, Google, Facebook, Apple. So they've got this money, right? They have $75,000 to $150,000. Yeah. And they have this belief that if I just add 3 to 6 inches to my height, I will be better at my job, or I will be taken more seriously, or I will, you know, go on a lot of dates, or whatever. It's a, you know, to a certain degree, it's about that belief, looking for a competitive edge in their career, right? It's interesting. I'm certainly not in a place to judge anyone on anything like this. Like, if this is something you feel you want to do to feel more like yourself, you know, understand what you're getting into. As a verifiable tall person myself, and you are tall as well, Micah, you know, I should also weigh the good with the bad, right? Like, I'm sure you see this little, maybe you don't, but you see this bump on my head. You know, the other day I slammed my head into a electrical box door. Rarely comfortable on airplanes.
Yeah.
Whether you want to or not, you stand out in a room. That could be either a good or a bad thing, right? There was the day that I walked into a very busy, I think it was like a a bar slash dance club, and I walked in and I realized I could see everybody. And the, and it's very like, it's a moment that I remember because I realized in that moment, wait a minute, I can see everybody. That means
everyone,
everybody can see me. And it was like this, like, oh no, I want to like crawl into a corner and not be seen by everybody, you know, every, you know, so anyways, there's good and there's bad with being tall. So I don't know if it's worth it for everybody.
Yeah, I agree. there's certainly the good and the bad. And you, I think, you know, I don't think about them until I'm in that moment where it is one of the bad times. Yeah. But overall, like, I'm happy with my height. And I also, like, if you can do this and it makes you feel better and it makes you happy, and again, if you're not hurting anyone, then I, by golly, go have this, you know what I mean? Like, these people, I celebrate them being able to do this if it makes them feel like the truer versions of themselves. And welcome to the club where I can look across at you. if that's what you want.
That's got to be an interesting transition to be short enough that your reality is used to looking up at people, and then to be in a situation where you're looking eye to eye or even looking down. Like, almost my entire experience is looking down, not like looking down on people, but like I'm tall enough that the literally absolute majority of people that I meet are shorter than me. And anytime I've ever stood next to someone who's taller than me and tried to talk, have a conversation, it's actually really hard for me because I'm just not used to that. And that may sound weird because, like, most people listening to this podcast probably know what it's like to look up and talk, but it's really foreign to me. So,
yeah. Oh man. All right.
Light tech
protecting
story.
My femurs. I got to tell you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Hold on to your femurs. Hold them close. All right. Up next, we're going to get to your story of the week, Micah. But before we do that, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Podium. If you own a small business, you already know that the past few years have been really hard, right? Supply chain issues, that's led to increased demand. On top of everything else that business owners have to contend with, have to manage, the businesses who are thriving right now are the ones who are forward thinking. And Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that make it easy for your customers to connect with your business. A lot of people hate calling a business. Maybe it's the plumber or a landscaper, and having to play phone tag. You know, they don't want that. They would much rather just send a quick message. So if you're running a business and the only way to get in touch with you is a phone number, you might actually be losing people as a result. And that's why Podium is so powerful. Podium gives businesses the tools to compete with the convenience offered by bigger businesses like Amazon. And, you know, Leo's talked about it many times. I've certainly experienced it where I get an offer through text message. I mean, when I think about the many different facets of messaging that are at my disposal, emails go unread. Sometimes a message coming through in like a Facebook Messenger, if it's from someone I don't know, you know, I automatically archive that. If it's a text message, I'm like 99.9% sure to open that. Even if I'm opening it and it's from somebody I don't know, like, it's a text message. It feels more personal. It comes right to you. So those messages always get open, almost always. From healthcare providers to plumbers, over 100,000 businesses are texting with customers through Podium. While customers love the convenience, businesses love the results. One car dealer sold a $50,000 truck in just 4 text messages. How about selling a vehicle via text? A jeweler sold a $5,000 ring and coordinated curbside pickup all through texts. A dentist sent out payment requests through texts and received 70% of their outstanding collections in only 2 weeks. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, you can do even more than just chat. You can get online reviews by sending an easy-to-use link. You can collect payments fast from anywhere, send marketing campaigns that actually get a response, all by sending a quick text. I think you're getting the message. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. That's podium.com/twit. Podium, let's grow. And we thank Podium for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. the Be Real clones are upon us. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we kind of knew that wouldn't take long for lots of companies to hop on board the Be Real train. For folks who don't know, we've talked about Be Real here on the show, but just in case, Be Real is this social app that at some random time during the day will notify you it's time to be real, at which point you are meant to open the app and within 2 minutes, I believe it is, take a photo of whatever it is you're doing. What Be Real does is it captures the front-facing camera, so whatever is in front of you, and the the front-facing camera, which is and the back-facing camera, meaning that it will capture both sides, both of the, the lenses on your camera. So you'll get typically when someone's doing a Be Real, it's going to be kind of a selfie and then whatever activity they're doing in front of them. Now, you are meant to post it within 2 minutes because the whole idea of Be Real is that it is a realistic and in the moment kind of expression of whatever is going on. You are only able to see what your friends are posting once you post your Be Real, and you can post it at a different time during the day, but it will kind of shame you for posting it late. So it's still possible that you can kind of see what everybody else has been posting for that day. And there's also kind of comments and reactions built in. Instagram has, in the time since, launched not a Be Real clone just yet, but the ability to take photos of both the front and back-facing cameras at the same time, as well as Snapchat had done that. But what TikTok just announced is something called TikTok Now. And TikTok Now is pretty much a direct copy and paste of Be Real. When you use TikTok Now, everybody else's posts who post to TikTok Now are invisible or blurred out or pixelated until you post yours. At a random time during the day, you will get notified that you need to hop in and post your Now. And in fact, it says, what does it say? The notification, instead of time to Be Real, says time to Now.
Time to Now. Really,
it's the time is now. Now.
That's what it should say. The time is now. The time is
that
now.
That would be good. See, they should have consulted.
Why didn't
you.
They do that? That actually seems like low hanging fruit. Seriously.
The one thing that is different with this from Be Real is that because TikTok is kind of a video company, first and foremost, you are able to capture a 10-second video or a static photo that you can share on your Now feed.
Okay.
So that's a little bit different and kind of interesting. And it will.
Had to know. Again, had to know the short roll video was right around the corner.
Oh, yeah.
On something like this. That makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. The one thing this TechCrunch article, I think we've actually had Amanda Silberling on the show before. Amanda writes about how a comparison between Be Real and TikTok is that TikTok does seem to be more privacy minded than Be Real has been, because Be Real, one of the features that you can use is a location sharing feature, and it is a very precise location sharing feature. So if you choose to post on Be Real with your location granted access to, you know, to the app, somebody who's, you know, on your Be Real, somebody who's your friend on Be Real is able to see that. Now, in theory, and in practice, from what I've seen, most people are pretty limited about who they give access to on their Be Real. I've declined a lot of people on my Be Real. I imagine you have too. And so it does stay pretty exclusive. So I think nearly everyone in my Be Real already knew my address before this, so I wasn't too worried about that. But what is good is that TikTok is a little bit more, is being a little bit more mindful about how this service works. So I'm gonna read a little bit from the article because I think it very well summarizes. like TikTok itself, if someone under the age of 16 registers for a standalone TikTok Now app, their account will be set to private by default. Plus, users must be 18 to share their TikTok Now posts on the Explore feed. The Explore feed is the public part of TikTok, so where everyone could see it. For users 13 to 15, only your friends, the people you follow who also follow you back, will be able to comment on those posts. Even for users 18 and up, the default setting will allow only friends to view your posts, even though they can change their settings to share with the world if they desire. So, TikTok, I like that they're thinking of that first and foremost, because as I said before, I think that a lot of times what we see is companies rolling out stuff and then having the realizations afterward of how they need to walk certain things back or adjust certain things or improve upon certain things. And it's particularly regarding these privacy implications and impact in that way. So it's good that TikTok is being mindful of that. But I am just not surprised to see any company copying Be Real, and I will not be surprised if Instagram within the coming weeks announces its Be Real clone.
It's gonna happen.
Bum me. Yeah, it bums me out a little bit because I like the uniqueness of Be Real, and I think that this is. It felt a little different when Instagram added stories after, and the guy who ran Instagram at the time, and I think it's the one that still does, just straight up admitted, like, yeah, we took that from Snapchat. It was a great idea and we wanted it in our platform, so we did that. But Snapchat was already established as a messaging app. It had, you know, life. And so it didn't feel like it was just a wholesale rip of what Be Real is. And I think that that harms its chances of growing more than it has. And that worries me because that leads to these, you know, big tech companies once again kind of claiming the space and not letting kind of these little players thrive. So a little bit of a
doing
bummer
what they do. I mean,
doing
it's
what
just
they do, but yeah, I can't
old
be surprised.
As time.
Yes. Tale as old as time.
Yeah.
It's beauty and the filter. Anyway, that's TikTok Now. So if you have a TikTok, it should be rolling out to US users. If you don't have it yet, I think in the coming week, it will probably roll out to you. And so you will be able to post those 10-second videos. Oh, and they give you 3 minutes, not just two.
Oh, well, you know, I have to say about the whole Be Real thing and the time limit. Like, I know they say, like, you got to get that in or else. But I'll be honest, I'm rarely looking at my phone when that notification comes through.
Yep, same.
And so I end up putting it through. You know, sometimes I put it through the minute I see the notification, which could be an hour later. Sometimes I look at it and I'm like, now's not my time. Like, I'm not going to do it right now. And it's going to be 2 hours later, you know, and I end up doing it. There's really very little to keep me from, like, doing it on my own schedule. So does the TikTok Now service blank out everything until you submit? Did they copy that as well?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And they pixelate the photos until you
this
until
is
you post.
Such a blatant ripoff of it. But, you know, again,
yeah,
I'm not surprised
it
at all.
Is.
But.
And I want to be clear, when I'm talking about the time limit, I'm not talking about the random time of a day that it tells you to do it. And then if you don't do it within that time, you get shamed. I'm talking about once you hit that button and you have to take the photo, that
I
countdown.
See.
Yeah.
I see.
So you get 3 minutes with this. The countdown is 3 minutes before they don't let you take the photo. I came close. I was, you know, trying to get the framing right for a photo I posted the other day. And I had like 5 seconds left to take the photo. I'm uncertain of what happens if you don't take the photo within that time, if just that day you're not allowed to post or what. I don't know. So I might have to let that happen because I actually don't. Most days I see it come up and I just don't even post that day. I'm not sticking to it day by day. It's just like if I see it and I feel like doing it, then I'll post that day. Otherwise, I don't. So I can stand to like miss a day. I'll have to check and see what happens whenever you let the timer run out.
I have to say, though, something that I like about this and continue to like with Be Real, and I'm sure it'll be the same with TikTok Now, I'm guessing, is that, you know, it was only very recently, it was probably like within the last week and a half, that I realized that if I went into my profile, it showed me a calendar with all of my day's submissions. I was kind of operating under the assumption that it was ephemeral, that when the day was done, it was gone. I didn't realize that they kept a catalog. And so I kind of went swiping through and like, oh, it was kind of neat. Even as inconsequential as so many of these posts are on this type of service, because it's really like, what are you doing at any random time of the day? More often than not, you're not doing something that exciting. But it was still kind of nice because there were days where I was like, oh, yeah, you know, and that's my only photo to capture that random moment of my life. You know, I don't know how important it is, but it is kind of nice to have this little kind of like catalog of randomness from your life, you know, as opposed to the total manicured, you know, collection of photos that we're so used to doing. So yeah, there's something appealing about it for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think they've cracked something, and I want them to continue to flourish. That's what I care about.
Yeah,
Unfortunately, well, we're going to keep seeing this for sure.
Yeah, and TikTok's infrastructure is definitely more dialed in, I have to imagine, than BeReal's, because BeReal does have issues from time to time, you know, of getting impacted by so many users at once. And you do, I had the moments where I do one, and then it's like it gets forgotten or lost. And I think it just kind of, you know, it's like the streams get crossed because there's so many people using it at that one time that it just, I have to do it again. So, you know, things like that happen. Probably less likely to happen with a company like TikTok doing it, just because they have their infrastructure so nailed down at this point. So,
yeah.
Anyways, interesting. TikTok now. There we go.
TikTok now. It's time to now.
It's time to now. That just sounds weird.
It's very goofy.
Right now is the time where we end the show. So Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. Go there and you'll find all the ways to subscribe to this podcast, audio, video, YouTube. It's all there. Check it out.
And if you want to get all of our shows ad-free, well, you can do that by checking out Club Twit, twit.tv/clubtwit. For $7 a month or $84 per year, you out there, yes, you, can get every single Twit show with no ads. So no ads, no interruptions, just the delicious, scrumptious content. You also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra stuff you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, and lots of other goodies that are kind of events we have in our Club Twit Discord. Yes, the other benefit that you get. It is a place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. And you also get access to three or more, actually, great shows, including the Untitled Linux Show, my show, Hands on Mac, which is all about making the most of your Apple devices with lots of fun tips and tricks. That publishes every Thursday. And Paul Thurrott's Hands on Windows, a show with tips and tricks for those of you who use Windows. If all of that sounds great, well, check it out. $7 a month, $84 a year, twit.tv/clubtwit. And you can also subscribe to those shows using Apple Podcasts, and this one using Apple Podcasts, $2.99 a month, and you will get the audio feed of Tech News Weekly completely ad-free. If you'd like to tweet at me or follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, C-H-I-H-U-A-H-U-A.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Check me out again on Thursdays for Hands on Mac, on Saturdays for the Tech Guy radio show heard around the world, where Leo Laporte and I take your questions and do our best to answer them. And on Tuesdays for iOS Today, a show I host with Rosemary Orchard, where we help you make the most of your iPhones, iPads, Apple Watches, etc. Jason Howell, if folks want to... Oh, wait. I'm doing it as if you are an interviewee.
Folks want to reach out to you. Where can they find you online?
Jason, tell me everything.
Well, so I wrote all of this for The Verge, and I'm here. Thank you very much. No, I have nothing to do with The Verge. You can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell. You can find me doing All About Android every Tuesday at twit.tv/AAA. And yeah, I think that's really about it. Maybe BeReal, maybe TikTok now. Probably not TikTok now. To be perfectly honest. But anyways, big thanks to John Ashley, our technical director and producer behind the scenes. Big thanks to Burke for testing people and making sure they are good to go for our show. And thanks to you for watching and listening each and every week. We couldn't do without you. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.